July 1937, the world's most famous woman pilot disappears during her attempt to circumnavigate the globe. In 1988, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, a small nonprofit known by its acronym TIGER, began a science-based investigation of the Earhart disappearance. Decades of forensic research and a dozen South Pacific expeditions have now produced hard evidence from multiple disciplines to provide the long-sought answer to the riddle. In this series of conversations with Jones Sacks, TIGER Executive Director Rick Gillespie takes us step by step through the adventures, the setbacks, and the discoveries that uncover the evidence that has solved aviation history's greatest mystery.
Hi, I'm Joan Sacks. Like many of you, I've read newspaper and magazine articles, and I've watched television documentaries about TIGER's adventures and discoveries. As a member of TIGER, I've participated in research, and I know there is so much more to the story that has never been told. I've known Rick Gillespie and his wife, TIGER co-founder Pat Thrasher, for many years, so when Rick asked me to help him bring the behind-the-scenes story of TIGER's Earhart expeditions to the public in a series of podcast episodes, I enthusiastically agreed. Over the years, there have been 12 TIGER expeditions to the South Pacific, and we've organized the podcast into seasons. To follow the progress of the investigation, you'll want to listen to the episodes and seasons in order. For newcomers, we make it easy to catch up with the story so far by publishing a compilation at the end of each season. Now let's get to the next episode.
This episode is a compilation of the three episodes in season 9.
Hi, Rick. At the end of season 8, it was the spring of 2012. You were convinced that if the wreckage of Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra was on the reef slope at Nikumaroro, it was in deeper water than you'd been able to search with a small ROV used on the 2010 expedition. Going back with better technology was going to take a much bigger, more expensive ship, and you expected it would take at least another year to put that together and raise the money. In the meantime, you were planning that big symposium in Washington to mark the 75th anniversary of the Earhart disappearance. Then the State Department stepped in.
Yeah. You know, it's hard for me to even talk about 2012. All the earlier expeditions, including 2010, which was a great expedition, but very difficult to put together. Those had always felt like climbing a steep mountain. It was hard, but you could see what the obstacles were, and you eventually got to the top and got the expedition put together.
Is this just in the planning stages? You felt like that?
Yeah, For 2012, it felt like climbing an active volcano.
Why?
Things,
in what way?
Things were happening that there's no way you could predict. We couldn't. It was surreal. Let me just explain. We had this photograph, and we've talked about that Eric Bevington, the Colonial Service officer, took during his visit to Nikumaroro in October of 1937. And it turned out to show this one photograph, show something sticking up out of the water on the reef that for a while we called it Nessie because we didn't know what it was.
Right.
And then it turned out to be our analysis, our forensic scientist's analysis, Jeff Glickman's analysis, was that it was the wreckage of a Lockheed Electra landing gear. I said, whoa.
Yes.
That's a lot of eggs to have in one basket. I asked for help from the State Department because we'd made some connections there and they had offered help.
Right.
And they have government photo analysts look at it. And their conclusion was, we agree with your guy. This appears to be Lockheed Electra wreckage. And by the way, stop calling it Nessie because the Loch Ness Monster is a myth. This is not a myth. This is real. You know, we can't be sure it's Lockheed Electra, wreckage, but that's what it looks like.
Wow. But you couldn't use that, right?
Well, they didn't let us use it. They wanted to, you know, keep it quiet because they didn't want anybody knowing that they had worked on it, because they weren't really supposed to be working on stuff like this. But then they did report back to the State Department, and the guy at the State Department couldn't keep his mouth shut. And he let the Secretary of State know about this, Hillary Clinton at the time. And suddenly I get told that I get called into the State Department and told, hey, we want you to do this expedition and go out there and find that airplane, but we want you to do it this year. And we don't want to wait till next year. Well, the reason they didn't want to wait till next year, because Clinton wasn't going to be Secretary of State next year. They wanted it to happen on their watch. But they didn't say any of that. They just said, we want you to do it this year, and we'll help you all we can. We can't give you taxpayer money, but we can help you raise money. As a matter of fact, this is what I was told, you know, Google is going to provide funding, and Lockheed Martin is going to provide all the technology you need, search technology, for free.
Wow.
And, Chevron is going to provide the fuel for the ship, and FedEx is going to cover all the shipping for this. And all Tiger has to do is raise the money to pay for the actual ship charter. And to help you do that, we're going to hold a big event here at the State Department in the Benjamin Franklin room with the chandeliers and the whole thing, and get you all kinds of press attention and help you raise money. Well, good God, you know, you can't pass up a deal like that.
No,
and
but still, it was spring of that year, right?
This is like February. I get hit with all this.
Oh, gosh.
And we have this big symposium planned, and I'm supposed to be promoting that and putting that together. But now I've got friggin' Secretary of State telling me they want to help us do the expedition that year.
Yes, but that is an incredible offer, though.
Okay. Surreal, like I said.
Yes.
So, based on those assurances, we signed a contract with the University of Hawaii to charter their 223-foot oceanographic research vessel, Ke'imika Okanaloa, which is kind of a mouthful, so everybody calls it KOK, for a 26-day expedition. 8-day voyage from Honolulu down to Niku, 10 days of search operations, and then 8 days back to Hano. You know, okay, great. And KOK is a huge ship.
I mean, yeah.
I was trying to think. I think the only time I had ever been on a ship bigger than that was one time I took the ferry across from England to the Netherlands. You know? this is crazy. So that the price tag for that charter was going to be $785,000. That's a lot of money. And all that got us with was the boat and the hull-mounted mapping sonar that came with it. The search technology we really wanted were the 2 3-person manned submersibles that KOK was designed to deploy. But the subs were undergoing an overhaul and upgrade and would not be available until the next year.
Oh, geez.
We'd have to go with whatever Lockheed Martin could provide, but at least it would be free. Okay, so here we go.
Yeah.
Then after committing to do the expedition and signing the charter contract for the ship, we found out that, as it turned out, Google and Chevron would not be contributing after all.
Oh, no.
The nation said, oh, no, never mind. FedEx was still on board. But the worst blow was the discovery that Lockheed Martin didn't have any search technology appropriate to our mission. We checked with them and asked, what do you have? No, that's not. They're in our, they make airplanes. Okay.
Yeah.
They do all kinds of other technology, but they didn't have anything that we needed. The best they could do was donate $200,000, which they agreed to do. So, well, we had a boat to take us to Niku, but no technology to search with when we got there. with 2 weeks to go before the big event at the State Department on March 20th, we had to find a contractor with the right equipment and fast.
Really?
All right. In 1991, we had hired Oceaneering International to do a sonar survey around the entire island. Oceaneering was no longer in business, but the manager I had worked with back then was now running his own underwater search company, Phoenix International, based in Washington, D.C. area. They did a lot of government contract work, like when the Navy had an accident with an aircraft carrier, something called a cold cat shot, where the airplane goes into the drink instead of
away.
They'd go out and find the airplane. We got together, the manager, now owner of Phoenix, and I. We got together, we talked about NICU. Towed array side scan sonar is a problem on a steep reef face. One side of the device sees a foreshortened image, and the other side sees only water.
Oh.
Towing this thing behind a ship, and you have to tow it right side up. So it just doesn't work very well. He recommended something called an AUV, an autonomous underwater vehicle. This is really very new, state-of-the-art stuff in 2012. An AUV is, well, we had actually used a small one on the 2010 trip to do a side-scan sonar of the lagoon, the flat bottom of the lagoon. It's basically a robot torpedo. But this one was much, much bigger than the one we surveyed with the lagoon. The thing is probably 40 feet long.
Really?
I mean, this is like a torpedo.
Could it handle the slopes?
Well, that's the thing about an AUV. You're not towing it behind a ship. You program this puppy to go out and fly down the reef slope rather than across the reef slope.
Ah.
And now you're searching with both sides of the side scan. And then when it gets to the bottom, it's supposed to turn around and fly back up. It's like a ski slope. You know,
yeah,
like a ski lift is the right analogy.
Right.
Sounds great. Okay. And then any anomalies we'd find, we would check out with a large ROV, much bigger than the little thing we used back in 2010. Phoenix International didn't have an AUV, but they could rent one and have trained operators come along to operate it. And then there was an outfit out of Louisiana that serviced the Gulf oil industry, an ROV operator called Submersible Systems. They're really good, and they had a nice big ROV that we'd get them aboard, and Phoenix would just serve as the general contractor for that. You know, this is a very different expedition than any we'd done before. Expeditions in before were carried out by Tiger personnel, both professionals like myself and volunteers. And then we have an occasional contractor to do some small specific job. Mm-hmm. This time, everything was going to be done by a contractor. You know, all I could do was come along and watch and advise and direct to the extent I could. But most of it was out of my hands. Now, the ROVs would be controlled from a self-contained command center in a modified shipping container. It would be mounted on KOK's deck. And so the ROVs would be lowered over the side with a big crane, and so would the AUV, and that's how we'd operate. It all sounded like a workable plan. But when we got all through, the price tag for all this came to another $860,000.
Oh, wow. On top of
Of the University of Hawaii charter.
Wow.
Which is, what do we say, 758,000? So, shit, man. Now, the University of Hawaii would let us pay in three payments, a couple of smaller payments and then a big balloon payment at the end later in the summer. But Phoenix wanted their money up front, all of it. But before the expedition sailed, they had to have their whole $860,000 before they'd do anything. So this expedition that started out to be almost a free ride is now a $2 million trip.
Gosh.
$1.6 million of that would have to be paid before we sailed on July 2nd. That was the target sailing date for Honolulu.
Wow.
Okay, so, all right, see ya. $1.6 million got a raise before July 2nd. And Lockheed Martin was, they were good for $200,000.
Yeah, but that doesn't look like much in comparison to the...
Well, you don't lift a gift, look a gift horse in the mouth.
No, true.
Discovery Channel was in for another $200,000 for the documentary film rights. They were with us in 2010, and they were willing to come back in 2012.
Wow.
And we had pledges from the Tiger membership. God bless them, that totaled almost that much more again.
Wow.
All very generous and gratifying. But as I went into that State Department press event on March 20, we're $1 million short.
Wow.
So, man, okay. We had a great turnout for the press event and terrific media coverage. Important people got up and said wonderful things about Tiger and about me.
Of course.
But I assured everyone that we would do our best to complete this historic mission. And inside I'm wondering, how the hell am I going to find $1 million unless I start robbing banks?
Oh, no.
Like I said, I think back on that, and I thought, God, I can get myself into some awful messes. The next few days after the press event, I did dozens of media interviews. And those interviews got picked up by newspapers, radio stations, and generated lots of attaboys and well-wishing, but no dollars.
Did they think you were funded, that you're coming from the State Department and all of this?
Oh, we need to raise money. I said, well, good luck, you know.
Oh, gosh.
It's like the old vaudeville thing. You don't applaud, just throw money, okay? But but then, geez, I guess it was like 5 days later, we got an email from a guy we'd never heard of who asked about funding opportunities. Okay, your ears pick up when... but he said he wanted to come along. All right, well, you know, that's not unusual. And we had used what we called sponsor team members before.
Right.
But you always check them out. You don't get on a boat with somebody that you're not sure about. It has to be a sizable contribution to be worth it. There's a phone number at the end of the email. And I called him up after a day or so. And I explained who I was and that I'd gotten his email. And I said, I understand you're curious about funding opportunities. And he says, that's right. And I also understand that you'd want to come along on the expedition. Well, that's right. Yeah, I would. You understand that normally we require a fairly substantial contribution to do that. And, well, what's your budget? I said, all right, now it's looking like a $2 million budget. He says, oh, I'd do half.
Oh.
And I about fell off my chair.
Wow.
I had never heard of this guy. And he wasn't asking for more information. There seemed to be no due diligence here at all. He says, wow. I'll come along, I'll give you half your budget, $1 million.
Now, how had he heard from you? One of the media outlets? Or what did he know about it?
He had read about us in an article. It was an AP story that had been picked up by a local newspaper in Wyoming. And that's where he read about us.
Wow.
And then he just got the email address and, you know, sent me the email.
I mean, he didn't even know when it was, for sure, I guess.
Well, he had the information that was in the interview, and I'd run through, you know, here's where we're going to go, and here's what we're going to do, and here's how we're going to do it, and, you know, and...
Wow.
So I said, well, how about I send you some material for you to review? He says, yeah, that'd be all right. I said,
just sign me up.
I would like to get together with you and at least meet you in person. And so we agreed to get to, he was at that time, he was at one of his homes up, it was in Rhode Island.
Ah.
I flew up to Providence and we had lunch. He was a nice enough guy, older gentleman, and obviously very, very wealthy. And he was just willing to do this. And before we'd even had lunch, we had a transfer of stock that we, of course, immediately sold that was worth, I think it came into $1,054,000. Boom. Wow. Like that. Whoa. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Jeez. It's like Deus Ex Machina. You know, suddenly something totally unexpected had apparently saved our bacon, you know. Now, we still didn't have enough to pay all the rest of, we're still like $400,000 short to pay University of Hawaii everything we owed them, but they were looking for that money right away. We had till the end of the summer to raise that. But we could pay Phoenix, and we could pay the required money for University of Hawaii. We could pay airfare, et cetera, and get the team together. And and Phoenix decided not to rent an AUV. They bought one.
Oh.
And I decided to use this expedition as on-the-job training for their people to use this new toy that they had bought for themselves.
Wow.
So,
well, a good opportunity for them.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity for them. So, and FedEx got on board with this thing, man. I think they spent more on the public relations, marketing, and the whole participation in the expedition than they did on the actual shipping costs. You know,
really?
They shipped the AUV and the ROV and all that gear.
Oh my gosh.
To Hawaii. I mean, shipping containers, I mean, huge stuff. And that's loaded then aboard this big ship. But the shipping containers are just emblazoned with FedEx logos and slogans and stuff.
Sure.
And they had a whole team out there working with us to do interviews and manage press. And they really got behind it. They did a fantastic job. So wow. There we go. You know, we get on the airplanes and we go to Hawaii. And we arrive there at the dock in Honolulu, and there's KOK towering above the wharf in front of me. I say, oh my God, this is my boat. Okay. As if things weren't interesting enough at that point, they were about to get a lot more interesting. But we're going to...
Really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, the volcano was still cooking.
Oh, no.
Yep. We'll talk about that next time.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
To hear about that. Hi, Rick. When we left off last time, you just arrived in Honolulu for the departure of the 2012 expedition using the University of Hawaii's oceanographic research ship, KOK. It was a complicated long name, but KOK.
Right.
And some very sophisticated underwater search technology. But you hinted that there were some issues.
Oh, yeah. There are always issues. And
gosh, aren't they?
this one. Okay, so we arrive in Honolulu on Wednesday, June 27th, 2012. And the plan was to sail Pernicu the following Monday, which would be July 2nd, the
75th
anniversary of the Earhart disappearance. You know, music
Nice way to mark it.
You know, big deal. And okay, so we've got a small Tiger team. There's just me, our cameraman Mark Smith, who is shooting video for us and also for the Discovery Channel. We had our underwater archaeologist Megan Licklider-Munden.
Yeah.
We had our own still photographer, Tiger member of the professional photographer Lori Rubin, fantastic photographer.
Yeah.
And then we had one sponsor team member. It was a Tiger member named Andrew Sanger, who made a significant contribution. And then, of course, then we had our millionaire sponsor, who was...
Yes, I remember hearing about him.
$1 million.
Wow.
So, okay, there we are. Discovery Channel, in addition to Mark shooting, they had another cameraman and a sound man and a producer.
Wow.
And they were set up with a complete production suite aboard the ship. You see, they wanted a show to be ready to air within weeks of our return.
Oh, gosh. So they needed to be working on it while you were
They're shooting, editing, and creating the show as we go. I'd never heard of that happening. I mean, they're doing this on the fly.
Wow.
Now, to do the actual searching, we had these 9 contractors. There were 5 Phoenix International technicians, 2 instructors from the AUV manufacturer to teach them how to use the new technology. You know, Phoenix had decided to buy one of these robot torpedo state-of-the-art things, but they didn't know how to use it. So they had these 2 technicians come along to do the on-the-job training. And then there were 2 technicians from submersible systems to run the ROV. Okay, so we got a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, really.
Of course, we've got to have a Kiribati customs representative. Always
Kiribati
guy. And the original plan was for a customs rep from Christmas Island, which is, I guess, it's about 1,500 miles from Hawaii, but it's a lot closer than Tarawa. And there is airline service from Christmas to Honolulu. So that should be easier.
Yeah.
But it turned out, we discover when we get to Hawaii, that the airline service from Christmas, the schedule had been changed, and now they were only doing it on Tuesdays.
Oh.
And here it is.
And you were leaving on Monday.
Yeah, this is Wednesday, and we're leaving on Monday, so it's not going to work. Okay, so we can consult with Kiribati over the phone. Okay, we're talking to Tarawa. And the new plan is for us to stop at Canton Island on the way to Niku and clear customs there.
Oh, and so is it on the way?
It's a little bit out of the way. We'd probably lose a day doing it, but
will they come to you? And
well, if with the customs rep in Canton, you just stop in and they clear you into the country, and then you have to clear back out. You have to go. So this would be a detour, and it wasn't great. And then it turns out, wait a minute, no, we don't have a customs officer on Canton.
Oh,
all right. Well, they came up with a new plan. Okay. Instead of going by Canton, why don't you go to Niku by way of Christmas Island? And then you can pick up your customs guy there. Christmas is...
What was that? What did that mean?
It's like 480 nautical miles out of the way.
What?
And doing that detour, we're going to eat up most of our search days with longer trips.
Yes.
I mean, it's just, what are we going to do about this?
It's a bad start.
Meanwhile,
what happened?
Well, we were working on that. We were trying to think of something. We had a bigger problem. to deal with.
Oh no!
In our contract with Phoenix, we had specified that we need high definition video on the ROV because it's going to be taken video of whatever we find on there, and it's got to be
great
as quality. It's got to be good quality video. Well, the submersible.
I mean, otherwise, why would they do it?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's, we've got to have good video of whatever happens. The submersible systems ROV had a standard definition camera, but very poor quality. It's not at all acceptable for what we needed. So Phoenix rented a high definition camera to be mounted on the SUV, and they shipped that to Hawaii. Well, the guy from Submersible Systems that ran the ROVs, his name was Wolfgang Burnside. Now, I
that sounds like it's from a cartoon.
I need to explain Wolfgang. Okay. Wolfgang is a Scotsman, and he sounds like a Scotsman. Burnside, you know, okay. But Wolfgang? All right. his father was in a Black Watch regiment during World War II and stationed in Germany after the war and met his wife, who was a native German.
That explains Wolfgang.
So his wife named their child Wolfgang. And Wolf was a great guy. I love Wolf. I mean, he and I got along just famously. But he had never seen this camera until it got to Hawaii. And he got to Hawaii and discovered that there's a fundamental mismatch between the camera system and the ROV system. The camera was not controllable from the command center we had in this container set up. And he'd be unable to trigger the recording on it. It's not going to work. And without HD recording capability on the ROV, there's no point in doing the expedition. And we've got 3 days before we're supposed to leave to figure this out.
Oh, jeez.
So we go to Phoenix International and say, hey, you guys, what you ended up sending us is really just a consumer grade Sony Handycam in a waterproof housing, and the system doesn't match up with the ship's system. And they said, well, you guys have to figure this out, but because we're totally consumed here in getting our AUV set up and running, it's our new toy and we got to know how to use it, and so you guys deal with it. So here's Mark Smith, our camera guy, and Wolfgang, and me standing there scratching our heads, and we gotta somehow figure this out. This is up to us. So okay, the ship's power is not steady enough to work with the the ROV camera. So we need clean,
like not consistent enough.
Well, we need cleaner power. It needs to be more steady. The ship's, it's an old ship, and the power fluctuates too much. So what we need to do is go get a motorized generator to put between the ship's power and the ROV to smooth it out. That should solve the problem. But that connection requires a special adapter, just a little thing, you know, about the size of your thumb, that doesn't seem to exist in Honolulu. I mean... Okay, so turning back to our Kiribati rep problem, the best solution to this seems to be to delay our departure for a day so that he can come on the Tuesday. And that'll work. We won't be able to depart on the anniversary of the flight and all that, but it's better
than
going to Christmas Island. Now, I've got to buy an airline ticket for him. His name is Sam Thickery. I got to buy a ticket for Sam, but I can't do that until I get his passport information. And So there's this mad scramble where we're going back and forth in email and getting in touch with him, and he's got to send us his passport information. Well, we got that sorted out, and I got him his ticket, and he's all set to arrive Tuesday morning, and we'll sail as soon as he leaves customs on July 3rd. Okay, so here it is Saturday, and Mark has found the needed adapter for the HD camera system by turning Honolulu upside down. Even so, the image quality is going to be marginal. It's just not a very good camera.
I don't understand why they would bother putting a marginal camera on a piece of equipment that was so highly technical and expensive.
Well, that kind of puzzled us too. I was not happy. You know, the way things go, I'm feeling like Han Solo in the trash compactor. You know, I got a bad feeling about this.
Oh, gosh. You're at way more than three strikes right now.
On Sunday, July 1st, FedEx holds this big press conference. And they've got a nice tent there at dockside with KOK towering above the podium. And there's good food, and CNN is there, and the local news affiliates are there, and I put on a brave face and tell everybody how we're going to go out and find Amelia. Okay, you do what you have to do.
Yeah.
The next day, July 2nd, the day we were supposed to leave, KOK went out and down to the fueling dock and took on 46,000 gallons of diesel.
Oh my God, really?
46,000 gallons. And of course, the original sales job was that it was to get paid for by the oil company, but we're paying for the fuel.
Wow.
And then the next morning, Sam arrived as scheduled and cleared customs. And we got aboard the ship and we go down the channel, past the Aloha Tower, the famous landmark, and turn out to sea. And you have Diamond Head there slowly receding in the distance. I had done this before, 21 years before, in 1991, when we said,
yes, I remember when you were leaving.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were thinking that you're going the same route that they had gone out to search for Amelia?
Yes, we were following in the wake of the USS Colorado. This whole thing was feeling like an old movie, you know. it was pretty cool. You know, they've got this huge ship, and I'm standing up there on the bridge wing.
Wait, did you have your hat on?
Oh, yeah.
Rick has a great selection of hats.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You've got to have your Admiral's hat on. And I felt like Chester Nimitz, man. This is the ship twice the size of the one we used in 91. And an expedition that's more than four times the cost. And, you know,
it's a little daunting.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like we're also duplicating the budget of World War II. Oh. And like, we don't have all the money raised yet. You know, here we go. We're $400,000 short, but we're underway. Mm. Okay, so as we plod southward, KOK proves to be slower than advertised.
Oh, no. Really?
He's good for maybe 9 knots.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, everybody tells you their ship will do 10 knots. And they knew it. Yeah. They never do. She can make 9 knots on a good day, and it's going to take us 9 days to reach Niku instead of 8 days.
Oh, no.
And we're already a day late getting started.
Do you have any slush time on the far end?
No.
Like, could you possibly get back later?
No. You've got the charter is set.
Oh, right. So no matter how many days of research you get, you still pay the same price for the...
Well, you charter the ship for a certain number of days.
Right.
Whether you spend that time searching or riding on the ocean. And so as it turned out, looked like we were going to have 8 days on site instead of 10. And that's a 20% loss of search time.
I know. That's so frustrating.
Yep. Well, yeah.
Same overhead.
Yep. Well, we arrived off Nicomoraro at 1:30 a.m. local time on July 12th. The sea was calm. Scattered clouds, light easterly wind. It's gorgeous. You know, it's another beautiful goddamn day at Nicomoraro. And KOK immediately began collecting mapping data with their hull-mounted multi-beam sonar, mapping sonar. So they got right to work. And then after daylight, we got the AUV launched and ballasted. You've got to trim the thing up. You put it in the water, and it's got to float level, and there's a lot of running around with it. But by lunchtime, it was ready for a test run.
Oh, cool.
Which was quickly aborted because it was not behaving the way it was supposed to behave. It wouldn't do what it was supposed to do. All right, got to figure that out. Got to reprogram it. By lunchtime, it was ready for a test run. Put it back in the water, and they try again. And it's still not right. It keeps coming back to the surface instead of going off and doing what it's supposed to do. And so by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we gave up, hoisted the thing back aboard, said, well, let's at least test the ROV, see how that goes. So we put the ROV in the water, and it worked great. It was just right. It was fine.
Oh, good. That's the first thing. Yeah. That's been just right. I don't know. Maybe lunch was, but.
Well, okay.
Wow.
Now it's 4:30 and we're going to try the AUV again. They think they've got it fixed. We'll try it for a 4-hour test. And if that goes well, they'll put it back in the water for a 12-hour all night mission. Cause that's kind of what we needed to do, is run this thing all night. So we put it in the water at 4:30 for this 4-hour test run. And less than an hour later, it's hung up somewhere off the main lagoon passage at a depth of 1,604 feet. We don't know why, but it won't come up. It's stuck somewhere. We're going to have to go rescue this thing with the ROV. That means Wolfgang has to get the thing set up for a deep mission. And it's getting dark. And Wolfgang's worried because the tether for the ROV had to be spliced to accommodate the high-definition video feed. Splice had not had time to cure. It's like a glue stuff that you put on it. And he didn't feel comfortable that there'd been enough time for the thing to really be watertight. And if the splice failed at depth, the tether would be ruined.
But what about, I mean, does that mean the ROV takes off on its own?
No.
Or, I mean, you can still recover it?
Instead of having the thing on an umbilical where you can control it, it's like you have it on a rope.
Right. Know, oh, geez.
All you can do is haul it back aboard. And it's no tether, no ROV. But we've got a $2 million AUV stuck underwater that needs immediate rescue. So you have to take the chance. At 8 p.m., Wolfgang felt we were ready, and he launched the ROV. We're ready to start the search. And he goes off looking for it, and he can't find the AUV.
Wow.
Now,
in what way were they trying to search for it? Did it have lights or GPS guidance?
No, it's purely visual. AUV has a strobe light on it that flashes, and the ROV has a camera that we're seeing in real time. So you're just swimming around watching for this strobe where you can go zoom in on that, but can't see anything. But in the process of searching, apparently the ROV tether snagged on the AUV, even though we didn't see it. We snagged it with the tether, which knocked it free, and the AUV came to the surface.
Wow. Well, what about the ROV?
Oh, the ROV was fine. Yeah, it was good. No damage to the ROV. AUVs on the surface, unharmed. And by 11 o'clock that night, we had both the AUV and the ROV back aboard.
Wow. So,
all we'd accomplished the first day was almost losing both of our search devices. Now, so there's all this running around trying to deal with these emergencies and making decisions. And all of this is being filmed.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the cameras are there all the time. At least one camera was following me everywhere I went.
Oh, my gosh.
I was wearing two, sometimes three mics, recording everything I said.
Oh, no. I can imagine
that. I'm afraid much of it required some judicious editing. It was not.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, all right. Let's talk about day two. 8 o'clock in the morning, they launched the AUV for a one-hour test, and it seems to be working okay.
Wow.
And they reprogram it for a four-hour data collection run. And maybe we'll finally get some work done. It goes out, and it does. Now, remember, the reason we're using an AUV instead of towed array sonar is the AUV being totally independent of the ship. It's not being towed. So it can be programmed to fly down the reef slope and then turn around and fly back up the reef slope. So you're getting a good image off both sides of the torpedo, the AUV.
Okay. Right.
Well, great in theory. What actually happened is it did a successful downhill run, but when it turned around to come back up, it bumped its nose into the slope trying to come back up. Now that triggers an emergency ascent.
It
drops a ton of weight. And the whole.
So it gives up? It just gives up?
Oh, yeah. Well, it says, oh, something bad happened. Abort, abort. It drops the weight, and it comes back to the surface. Of course, it takes an hour and a half to get back up to the surface.
Oh, geez.
Okay. So we bring it back aboard. We find out that the collision with the reef slope had cracked one of the lithium battery housings.
Oh, no.
Yeah, lithium battery. These are big lithium batteries.
Oh, gosh, I bet.
And it was leaking water. The damaged battery is smoking like the devil and shorting out the rest of the system. They get this thing on deck and they get it opened up. And we've got this is a very dangerous situation because if the battery had spilled onto the deck, it would eat right down through the hull of the ship.
Oh, gosh.
So this is major full firefighting precautions. Everybody.
And they knew how to do it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That was something that
this is a train. They're trained for this. But
the crew or the people running
the AUV crew had their firefighting training, and they knew how to deal with this kind of thing. And they were all over it, and nothing bad happened. But it was of concern. Okay, so we get that taken care of. The AUV gets repaired.
And they had an extra battery on board?
Oh, yeah. They've got an extra battery, the replacement parts. And they find that even though the run had been aborted because of the collision with the reef slope, the data they collected was good.
Oh, that's good.
Okay, the downhill data was good. Okay, new plan. We're going to fly downhill and then tell the AUV to just come back up and we'll go downhill again. Don't try to fly back up. Just come straight back home and then we'll do another run down.
You have to reprogram it every run?
They can program it to go down the slope at the bottom.
And just film on the downhills?
Yeah. Well, they're going to be collecting data as it floats back up, but there's not going to be anything interesting there.
Right.
But at least I think keep working.
Yes.
And it'll go back and do another downhill run. We call this the ski resort solution. You know, ski down the hill, and then you come back up on the ski lift and you ski down again.
Well, how did that work out?
Well, the ski resort solution worked. They collected good data that way, and the thing didn't get busted. But of course, it's not collecting data at the same rate.
You're collecting
data at half the rate at best that you were before. Mm-hmm. Well, you do what you have to do. Okay.
Yeah.
Now it's day 3. 8 o'clock the next morning, we recovered the AUV after a successful all-night mission. Got a lot of good data that was to be processed. And we launched the ROV for a 6-hour visual search of the reef slope. We're going to go down and see what we can find. Okay, so you got to imagine this. We got this big old shipping container on deck that's set up as a command center. It's packed with high-tech stuff. And there's like a cockpit where Wolfgang and I sit side by side. And there are these big screens in front of us where we're seeing real-time pictures of what the ROV is seeing. It's dark, you know, when it's quiet. Wolfgang flies with a control stick off to the side. And my job is to just sit there and watch what we're seeing, and see, hoping that something interesting is going to turn up.
Well, this sounds like a very different day than you had normally spent on NICU.
Oh, geez. Yeah. I mean, this is... It's kind of weird. You sit in this little cockpit, and because you're looking at whatever the ROV is seeing in real time, and because you're so isolated from the rest of the world, it creates this illusion that you're there in the ROV. It's like you feel like you're down there with it.
Oh, interesting. And, were your photographer tags in there with you? Were you being filmed for that too?
Mark had a camera set up that was watching me and Wolfgang.
Oh, just running
just
all the time?
All the time, getting our reactions, because if something were to turn up on the screen,
oh gosh,
dramatic,
yes,
they'd want to have our reaction to that. And that's right. The thing. You're sitting there, and it's like... Okay, so you're 300 meters down, 984 feet. And it's like searching a rugged mountainside on a dark night with a flashlight in a snowstorm. Because there are all these little white flakes of pieces of coral that the fish have chewed off and up higher. And it's just kind of snowing, this stuff. It's very strange. Wow. And it's hour after hour of this, nothing but coral. And yet, you know that any moment, something might appear that will change your life.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be afraid to look away.
Right. And yet, I couldn't stay awake.
Can picture that.
Not shaking myself. And Mark's sitting out there watching and laughing his ass.
Oh my.
So, you know, that's what it was like. It felt like a spaceship. You know?
Yeah.
They're really. Like you're in the nose of the Millennium Falcon or something.
Uh-huh.
All right. So we did that for 6 hours, and that afternoon we recovered the ROV, and then at 5:45 we launched the ROV for another mission, but the generator failed, and we blackout of the propulsion, video, positioning, telemetry, everything. We're blind, no control. We got to bring the thing back aboard.
Oh, geez. Is this the generator on board that was supposed to be evening out?
We had put on board.
Yes.
But that thing failed. And in the meantime, we got this ROV down there that we don't have a control over, and we were really worried the tether might foul in the ship's propeller screws.
Oh gosh.
Which would
yes, that would be dangerous. Really well.
But it didn't happen. We recovered the ROV safely and another little adventure. All right. So at 7:30 that night, we launched the AUV for another all night mission.
Mm. So it liked the ski run missions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we collected good data.
Oh, good.
And we recovered the AUV the next morning. This will be day four. Recovered the data and it's being processed. See what they could see. And by 10:30 in the morning, we launched the ROV again to investigate some targets that were identified in left.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. We saw a couple things here that looked like they might be man-made objects. We go off with the ROV looking for those things, and we find them. There were two targets, and both of them turned out to be coral boulders.
Oh.
Well, now we know that things that the AUV identifies as possible man-made objects can be big old coral boulders.
Okay. Hmm.
They identified another target that we found turned out to be a heavy metal hatch. Norwich City shipwreck debris.
Oh, wow. Yes, there would be that down there.
And what was really interesting about that is they had identified this isolated target. Oh, there's something over here you ought to check out. We go check it out, find out that it's a piece of Norwich City debris. But in the process of that, we see and fly over a whole big debris field in Norwich City debris, all kinds of big stuff.
Oh, that's frustrating. So it missed it? It missed all that?
The AUV never saw it. They flew right over it and didn't see it. They found this one little thing that we then went and found. But why didn't they see? Good grief. If they can miss a shipwreck, what else can they miss? You know, it sonar is like that. It's you're dealing with sound echoes. You're bouncing sound off things. And if you bounce it at the wrong angle, it doesn't register. You don't pick up anything. And so you can miss stuff. And boy, this was an example. They were really embarrassed when we came back and said, yeah, well, look what you guys missed. By this time, the guys had put this big taped sign across the top of their video monitors where they're processing all this data. And it says, worst possible environment. This is as bad as it can get. You know, this is the worst place to try to use a sonar.
Well, it's a good lesson for them, but I'm sorry you had to pay for it.
Well, yeah, that wasn't what we had in mind.
No. You had in mind what they said they could do.
So out they go. They're going to try again, see if they can see the shipwreck wreckage. The next morning, we recover the AUV and find out that during the night, it had run into the bottom on a downhill run. It just face plant into the bottom.
Thanks.
And scattered the nose cone on the thing. But this time it kept going. At least it didn't abort. And we had collected some really good data.
Oh.
All right, fine. So they bring the
thing. So you know where the Norwich debris field is. So you've got that really well documented.
Yeah. And they had collected a lot of data on the Norwich City wreckage before.
Oh, good.
Well, and I guess after they busted the nose.
Yeah. No water damage from the shattered nose?
There was no battery damage, apparently.
Good.
And they had another nose that they put on it. And, you know, but they're fixing that. We launched the ROV to go check out some of the stuff that they had seen in the Norwich City wreckage. Mm-hmm. But then we have to abort because we're getting intermittent HD camera outages.
Oh, how frustrating.
So we bring it back aboard and we switch to the spare camera and rig it all up again. And we're ready to redeploy about an hour later. And we discover that the ship's throttles are not working correctly.
Now, really?
You see, when you have an ROV over the side and it's tethered to the ship with this umbilical,
Oh.
You've got to keep the ship where it belongs. It's got to be, you've got a bow thruster and your regular propellers, but you're having to carefully manage the ship's position. And that means a lot of action with the throttle on the thrusters and the propellers. And Kalki was an old boat, and it just wasn't handling it. And they needed to work on the throttles, get them back working. So
did they come with a mechanic? I mean, part of their crew?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. To do that? They know how to fix their boat. But, We are stuck again, not doing the job that we're out there to do.
Right.
So while we're waiting for them to fix the throttles, we're examining this AUV data from last night. And lo and behold, it shows something, a sonar return, that looks for all the world like an airplane wing.
Oh, gosh.
Right in with the North City wreckage. And we had always figured that there was that possibility that wreckage from the Electra could end up in amongst the North City wreckage.
That just makes sense.
Yeah, well, the Electra went over the edge of the reef in 1937. The ship was already there, but the stern of North City didn't break off and tumble down the reef slope until 1939.
Oh.
Huh. They said, oh, my God, what if the stern of North City fell on top of the airplane wreckage?
Yeah, or definitely could see that it could be among debris.
And so we weren't terribly surprised to see, it's at about 1,000 feet down where the stern ended up, most of it. And we got this image that, God, that looks like a wing. We can see the ribs. It's the right shape. We really get down there with the ROV and check this out. But that's a bad neighborhood for an ROV because you've got all the shipwreck wreckage. And if you get your tether hung up on wreckage, you're in trouble. This is not a good place to be flying an ROV.
So the ROV is basically dragging the tether around?
Oh, it's just dragging it around.
Yeah.
You've got a couple of floats further back on the tether to kind of keep it up. But you've just got this long tail you're dragging along.
Yeah, that's not good.
And it's not unusual at all for the tether to get hung up on something. It's usually an outcropping of coral, and you have to stop and back up and figure out, unhook it. All right, now we're good. And it's just part of the game. But shipwreck wreckage is not something you want to be messing with. But
no,
that's where our target is. So by 1:30 in the afternoon, the throttles are fixed, and we launch the ROV, and we go and we poke around in the wreckage, and we can't find the damn wing target.
Oh, rats.
All right. Enough. We'll try this tomorrow. So by about 5:30, we recover the ROV. And at 9 o'clock that night, we launch the AUV for another all-night mission. It's been a frustrating day. We lost the entire morning due to mechanical issues with first the ROV and then with the ship.
And what's everyone else doing while you're investigating this?
While Wolfgang and I are...
Yeah, you're in the cockpit. Yeah.
And I'm...
we know what Mark and...
And they're shooting video. And the AUV guys are in their little... room with all their monitors, and they're processing the data collected by the AU day before.
Yeah, and I get that. But what about the people that came with you? Sponsor
Megan, the underwater archaeologist, is really standing by, waiting to be an underwater.
Have something to investigate. Yeah,
and to archaeologize.
Yeah,
how's that for a?
Yes, I didn't realize that was a verb.
Okay. And and Lori Rubin, our photographer, she's around snapping our picture.
Oh,
gosh.
Here's Rick smiling. Here's Rick yelling at somebody. Here's Rick wishing he was dead.
And what about your, like, nobody's gone on land, right?
No, nobody's been on land.
Your sponsors doing?
Sponsors are just
hanging out
with their hands in their pockets and reading books. And they wanted to come along, and we warned them. I said, this is not going to be, you're an observer, really. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds tedious, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, so what do you have left now?
They weren't complaining. They weren't saying, oh my God, we thought you guys were competent. Yeah. Yeah, so did we. That's where we were. But at least we've got an interesting target to investigate.
Yes,
there'll be a happy ending to this thing. Yeah, 3 days left. You know, I hope we've got all the different bugs fixed and
things. Seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. Things are about to get a lot worse.
What? Oh, no.
We'll talk about that next time.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, I'm eager to hear. Okay. We'll see you next time. Yeah. Thank you, Rick.
Hi, Rick. So at the end of the last episode, you just finished the fifth day of searching with 3 days left before you had to head back to Hawaii. You'd had problems with the equipment and the ship, and you hadn't found anything. And you had a sonar return from the AUV that looked like a wing in among all the Norwich City wreckage, but the ROV was having a hard time finding it to see if it really was airplane wreckage. And you were going to try again the next day. Time was running short, but you felt the technical problems had finally been sorted out. And then, at the end, and you always do this to us, you said there was more trouble ahead. So...
Yeah, well, that seems to be a recurring theme with technology at NICU.
It surely does.
At the end of day five, they sent the AUV out for another all-night run collecting sonar data. But when we came down for breakfast in the morning, we learned that the AUV had gotten hung up somewhere for 4 hours during the night.
Oh, gosh.
But it had freed itself. And continued, it was a deep mission. They were going really deep that day. But then it got stuck again as it was ascending for recovery.
Oh, no.
And now it was somewhere 722 meters down there. That's 2,368 feet.
Oh, my gosh.
Somewhere off the northwest tip of the island.
Wow.
Here we go again. We have to use the ROV to find and free the AUV. But this time, the rescue mission is going to be much more hazardous. The terrain in that area is a series of cliffs dotted with caves, and there are these large fern-like coral growths that stick up and can snag the ROV tether. You're always getting it snagged and you have to back up and untangle it. But what makes it really bad is that the ROV only has 800 meters of umbilical. So at 722 meters, we will be literally at the end of our tether. Wow. With only like a couple hundred feet of slack to work with. And the ship will have to maintain position very precisely directly above us while we search for the AUV. This is really tricky.
It does sound complicated.
Okay, so the ROV goes over the side about 8:30 in the morning. We're going to go look for this damn AUV again. And on the way down, the tether snagged on one of those big coral fans. Now, that reef slope is unstable. And when you pull something free, like one of these coral fans, it triggers a landslide, an underwater landslide. And that's what happened this time. And all this stuff, these big chunks of coral that got knocked loose when we pulled the coral fan loose, hit the tether, snag on the tether, and start dragging the tether down and the ROV with it. And here we are sitting in the command cockpit in the dark watching these screens, and it really does feel like you're down there with the inside the ROV. It creates this illusion, and suddenly it feels like we're being dragged to the bottom of the ocean. Oh my God. Oh. But it worked itself out, and it was okay. But it was just,
oh gosh,
whoa. So we're down there searching for over an hour. We eventually find the AUV. It's wedged crosswise in a cave.
It's like, so what'd you do?
It's like it parallel parked, yeah, inside the cave. So Wolfgang goes in with the claw on the ROV, and he gently grabs a handle near the stern of the fish and pulls it free, and it gradually makes its way back up to the surface. And so by 11:30 in the morning, both the ROV and the AUV are back aboard KOK. But because of the effort of keeping that ship directly over the ROV while we're doing the rescue, back and forth with the throttle, back and forth with the throttle, it trashed the throttle control system again.
Oh, no.
And it takes them about 7 hours to fix it. So we just lost the whole afternoon.
Wow.
So we lost the morning doing the rescue, and we're going to lose the whole afternoon. We've lost the day.
Wow.
Well, okay. So we'd been at Nikku for almost a week at that point, and we'd never left the ship. And with all the equipment failures, everyone was pretty frustrated and tense, and we couldn't do anything that afternoon anyway. So I thought, okay, this is a good opportunity to let everybody have some time on the island.
Had you planned to do that at some point anyway while you were there?
I figured there would probably be a time when it was right, but I was just waiting for the right opportunity, and this seemed to be it.
Yeah.
So we put a skiff over the side. Now, KOK is not like Naya, which has a dive deck that's specifically designed to get off and on the ship.
Right. Did they had a swim platform sort of at water level?
They didn't have any kind of platform at water level. KOK. For KOK, if you're going to get into a skiff, first you have to launch the skiff, and then you bring it up under a ladder that just goes down the side of the ship.
Oh,
it's kind of
wow.
a long ladder down the side. It's
that sounds kind exciting.
Kind of like getting in a landing craft in World War II. You know? But we got everybody into the skiffs, and there were 25 people that came ashore. We had to make several trips. And I played tour guide. You know, here's this, here's that. Let's go see Gallagher's tomb and so forth. Nikku really is a beautiful place if all you have to do is sightsee.
Yes, and
everybody had a good time.
Who else better to be the tour guide?
Well, I knew my way around.
Sure.
Lord knows. And by 6:30 that evening, we had everybody back aboard ship, and they'd all had their nice outing. Tomorrow, we'll use the ROV to go check out a couple of promising targets. We've got the wing among the North City wreckage that we hadn't been able to find on day before yesterday. Mm-hmm. And there was a target that Phoenix spotted up to the north. It was, we called it a teepee, because it kind of looked like a teepee-shaped sonar target that they were really very confident, very high probability that this is a man-made object.
Huh.
And of course, any sizable man-made object is something we absolutely want to look at. So it's day 7. We launch the ROV at 8:30 in the morning and head for the Norwich City wreckage to look for the wing. And after about an hour and a half of picking our way carefully through the shipwreck debris, because you really have to be careful,
I bet,
we found an object at the coordinates given to us by Phoenix. And it was definitely shipwreck wreckage. Okay.
Could you see that it looked like a wing? I mean, did it kind of have that shape?
It looked maybe sort of like what the sonar target looked like. And these are the coordinates where Phoenix says it was.
Right.
So we figured, okay, I guess that's it. And then from there, we went up north to check out the teepee.
Uh-huh.
It was a rock.
Oh.
Okay. Jeez. And that took a couple, 3 hours. So by lunchtime, we had the ROV back aboard, and we reviewed the video we'd shot of the object in the North City debris field, because we weren't real comfortable about that. And after we compared it to the sonar image of the wing, we decided that that's not the wing target.
Oh. Do you think it was still there?
Yeah, we need to try again. We're going to make a third attempt to find this thing that might be a wing. So we put the RV back in the water, and we head back to the wreckage. It's about 1,000 feet down. We looked around and did find a target, not at the coordinates of Phoenix Cave, but we did find a target that a feature that definitely matched the size and shape and general appearance of the sonar wing target. But the things that we had were hoping would be aluminum wing ribs turned out to be steel girders.
This is
ship wreckage that just happens to mimic the shape of an airplane wing.
Wow.
I'm not sure what part of the ship it was.
But you can imagine it was a big ship. So
had everybody fooled, but there it is, more ship wreckage. So the end of day 7. We've got 2 targets found and identified, and no airplane.
Wow.
Okay, so day 8 is going to be our last day. It's Thursday, July 19th, 2012. And once again, the AUV malfunctioned.
Oh, no.
It returned to the surface as it was supposed to, but it was in really close to the island, to the edge of the reef. It's not supposed to do that.
No. What happened?
Well, they had lost communication with it, so they weren't able to tell it what to do, and it came up wherever it decided to come up, and it turned out to be right in tight to the reef edge. Now, KOK has to get up right close to the thing to lift it back aboard.
Oh.
They have a crane, and it's got to be right there beside the ship. And the captain of the KOK tried to get in to recover it and said, no, I'm not going to do this. This is way too close to the reef edge.
Mm.
I can't let this ship get aground on that reef. And this is happening at 4 o'clock in the morning. So he musters all hands, and they launch a skiff, and they go in, and the AUV is in there in the surf, right? And it's dark, but they get in there and they attach a line, and they tow it out to deeper water where KOK could recover it. Captain was really unhappy, and he was not a pretty sight when he was unhappy. He's a great guy, but boy, you put his ship in danger like that, and he's So during that day, we continued searching with the ROV, but we didn't find anything of particular interest.
Mm-hmm.
And by 5:30 that night, the ROV was back aboard, and by 8 p.m., KOK was headed back to Honolulu.
That's disappointing.
Well, the adventures weren't over, as it turned out.
Oh.
The ship's propulsion system was in such bad shape after the abuses of supporting the ROV. Again, she was an old ship, and we had really run her hard.
So that wasn't how it was supposed to be used?
That wasn't supposed to be the way it was going to be used. So KOK could only limp along at like 7 knots, and there was this constant fear that the whole system would just quit altogether.
Oh, gosh, in the middle of...
Pacific Ocean. And they would have to send out a seagoing tug to find us and tow us back to Hawaii.
Oh, my gosh.
And God knows what that would have involved.
What an ignoble end to the trip that would be.
Jeez, it would... But...
What did she go on your way out there? Like, what was normal travel speed?
About 9 knots is what... which wasn't what she was supposed to make 10.
Right, I remember that.
But she would only make 8 or 9 on a good day, often 8. But here, we were doing good to do 7 knots.
And then the worry about it.
I mean, that's that was the worst thing.
Yeah.
You know, how's she doing? How's she doing? So far, she's doing good. But there's no way to predict.
Oh.
But she hung together, and we made it back in late by a couple of days, but we were okay.
Mm.
Now, all right. Our original plan had been for 10 days on site.
Right.
200 hours of searching over a period of 10 days of round-the-clock operations. What we got was 8 days on site because of longer than expected transit times to and from NICU.
Yeah.
And 86, not 200, 86 hours of searching due to repeated equipment failures.
Oh.
57%, over half of our time had been non-productive time.
Oh, that's so frustrating.
And the net result was that we were able to examine only a small fraction of the area we had hoped to cover. Earhart's Lockheed Electra might still be down there, and we just didn't look in the right place yet. So all we could do, we figured, would be to carefully review the data and the video we had collected to see if we had missed something and then figure out what to do next. That's all you could do. Meanwhile, our $2 million expedition was still $400,000 in debt to the University of Hawaii for the ship charter.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's kind of hard to raise money for an expedition that is already over and has failed to produce the hoped-for results.
Oh, jeez.
I've had fundraising challenges before, but that was a good one.
Wow.
So almost a year. By the following May of 2013, we had repaid $50,000, but we still owed them $350,000. And the university was, understandably, getting a wee bit impatient.
I can imagine.
This. Oh, man, we don't want to do this to them, but what are we going to do? Well, we've got to figure out something. Meanwhile, it was starting to look like the expedition might not have been as unsuccessful as we thought.
Oh, why? What happened?
Well, a close review of the ROV video by our forensic imaging specialist, Jeff Glickman, turned up what might be a debris field of coral-encrusted aircraft wreckage. Now, again, you're looking at video taken from an ROV, and these are chunks of coral that might not be chunks of coral. Maybe. Yeah, maybe this is airplane wreckage. And then we did this detailed analysis of the sonar data collected by Phoenix and spotted an anomalous shape on the edge of the slope of the reef that might be the Electra, but had not been noticed by Phoenix. They never said anything to us about it and said, why don't you go check this out?
Oh.
We found that ourselves, but after we got home doing a really detailed analysis of the data they had collected. Right. That was really their job, to spot stuff that might be airplane wreckage. But everything they had spotted that we went and checked out turned out to be either shipwreck wreckage or rocks.
Hmm.
So now we had something that, this thing is in the right place. And when I say the right place, we had figured that the airplane might logically be a little bit south and down a bit deeper than where we had seen the thing in the 1937 Bevington photo that we're quite sure was landing gear wreckage. Which indicated, if that's where the airplane went over the edge, leaving its landing gear behind, the airplane should be right down here someplace.
Hmm.
And it was the right down here.
So that's where the wreckage was.
Place that we saw this anomaly in the sonar data that was kind of the right dimensions to be a Lockheed Electra fuselage.
Wow.
So geez, you know, we got to go back and look at this. We may have found it and not known that we found it. But before we could even think about raising the money for a new expedition, we still had to figure out some way to pay for the last one. Well, fortunately, a very wealthy individual on our board of directors stepped forward and said, now, we can't string out the University of Hawaii like this. And he made it possible for us to pay off that debt.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, God, thank you. You know, he pulled our butt out of the fire. It wasn't the
first time
we've done that. No, it was great. But, you know, I have described that whole 2012 expedition as like trying to climb a volcano that unexpectedly erupts. Oh. Well, it turns out it wasn't through erupting.
Oh.
Yeah. It had another eruption in store for us. And this one was a doozy.
Oh, no.
The last thing on earth we expected. But we'll talk about that in season 10.
Okay, well, we will be eager to listen to that.
Okay.
Thank you, Rick. Fine.
Thanks for listening. The Earhart Expeditions is a serial history of Tiger's 12 expeditions to the South Pacific. We release a new episode each Tuesday. You can receive special bonus episodes and get access to Tiger's extensive video library by becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to Patreon, that's Patreon, and search on Tiger, Tiger. You can also be a part of the adventure and participate in research. Go to tiger.org and click on Join Tiger. See you next Tuesday.